Hi, everyone, and welcome. This is Seek Sustainable Japan. I am JJ Walsh, your host here in Hiroshima, Japan, and today, once again, joined by the amazing Douglas Brooks. Thank you so much for joining, Douglas.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you have a very exciting project coming up this month. You're coming back to Japan. I describe you when I give tours around Hiroshima, around Japan. I always talk about you and how you are the last apprentice. And that is true, right? You are like the last samurai, the last apprentice of now coming up to 10 artisans, 10 craftspeople who are about to retire. And you really are their last apprentice, right?
Well, yes. Yeah. That in my own personal experience. Yeah, that's been true. I've been the only apprentice for 7 of my 9 previous teachers. So,
yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. And your story dates back. We've had you on the show before. Thank you so much for joining once again. In previous episodes, we talked about how your students' boats from Vermont ended up on the Samurai series.
Yeah.
That was exciting.
Shogun, yeah.
Oh my gosh. Have you become famous because of that? Do people know they're your students' boats?
No, I don't know. They were props. You know, they were lost in that whole amazing set that they created. Though I did watch most of the series, and it was fun to pick out the boats, and there was a fair amount of work. There was a fair amount of filming on the water, and I did also consult on the warships, the samurai warships that they built for the series. So,
oh wow,
yeah,
and taught the actors how to row, didn't you?
Correct. I taught the extras how to use the sculling oar. That's right.
Yeah. That's so good.
And that was fun. That was fun to see any scene that had some of that action, and they were great, and they worked so hard, and really pulled it off. It looked great.
That's so fun. And then, of course, previous episodes, but just to catch people up, we've talked about your origin story. How did you get involved in wooden boat building in Japan? It goes back to when you were first a backpacker traveling around Japan. I love that story. Can you just give us a little recap?
Yeah. So I had just left a job as the working in the museum boat shop at the Maritime Museum of San Francisco. And that was 1990. And my college roommate, who is from Hiroshima and lives there now, I let him know that I was out of a job and kind of figuring out what I was going to do next. And he sent me a plane ticket to Japan. He'd been begging me ever since we met in college, he'd been begging me to visit Japan. So, you know, he left me with no other option. And so I traveled there, and I was kind of your typical backpacker, a little bit older. I was 30, but I had my Lonely Planet travel guide, and I had my youth hostel membership. And I kind of was on the backpacker circuit, and actually got to Hiroshima to visit Nobu and meet his family. And it was really at that point I decided, you know, I just really can't look at another shrine and temple. So I asked myself, well, what's something I'd never get tired of looking at? And the answer was immediate. It was boats. So I set off along the coastline and wound up fortuitously on Sato Island, which is home to this iconic boat, the Taraibune, the tub boat. And younger viewers who may be interested, their connection to Japan maybe through manga or anime, will know that, recognize that boat. It's the boat in Spirited Away, where the heroine, if I'm remembering the story right, escapes from this island. And Miyazaki-san, the maker of that film, did just a perfect job rendering the boat. Anyway, that's all long after I went to Sato in 1990 and met the man who became the last builder of tub boats. And I went back to visit him in 92 and 94. And on that third visit, he asked me to be his apprentice.
Yeah.
And so I was able to.
You wrote a lot of that knowledge in your first book.
Yeah, that's in my first book. Yeah. And that was born really out of, thank you very much. That was born really out of tragedy, because 3 years after I studied with him, he died in an accident. And the Kodoh Cultural Foundation on the island came forward and said to me, well, you were his only apprentice. What do we do? And I said, we'll do the traditional thing and I'll come back to the island and I'll teach an apprentice. And you'll do the non-traditional thing. You'll publish my research. So my book is essentially a how to build tugboats, with some ethnology history background in there too. But that's my primary goal, to leave a record so that a competent woodworker could recreate those boats.
And it's just amazing that really Japanese wooden boat building just has not been documented. And so I love the beginning of your article about the wooden barrel making, which you're coming back to now in Japan, to be a part of the workshops here, but how that was a dying art. And you had a 3 a.m. panicked call from someone you ended up going back and working with, right, in Osaka.
I went and visited him. He and I, I visited him a couple of times, and actually he told me, he announced that he was retiring and shutting this workshop down. And he was the last commercial builder of really monumental barrels, like 950 gallon. That's a sake barrel. That's, you know, that's probably 1200 gallon barrel. And so that was some years ago, and what unbeknownst to me, my book on building the tugboats is actually, every barrel maker I've met in Japan has a copy. And I didn't realize this, but nothing had been published, or nearly nothing had been published about the craft of building Japanese barrels. So my book was it. And tugboats are not exactly barrel. There's a few tiny little differences, but essentially it's recognizable to any barrel maker. And that was that 3 a.m. phone call. He got a copy of my book and just picked up the phone and called me. I am actually, my first stop returning to Japan here next month, early February, is to the Kioke wooden barrel event that happens every year on Shodoshima. Yes. Boy, you've done your homework. You've got some great stuff. At Yamaroku Shoyu, the soy sauce factory. And that was that last photo. And I'll be joining about 200 people there who are, you know, marketing fermented foods, traditional foods brewed in wood, and all these things. It's a really wonderful gathering. But from the craft side, it's so fascinating to me, because this cadre of younger barrel makers has come together, and they've abandoned this idea of the old traditional apprenticeship. And they've just said, you want to learn, show up, we'll teach you. And I guess to put it in the language of our unfortunate digital age, it's open source barrel making. And I'm amazed. I'm amazed and I'm fascinated, and I really look forward to seeing them again. I was there a year ago. And interestingly, several of them asked me or told me, you have to write a book on Japanese barrel making. And my first reaction back to them was, well, why don't you write it? I mean, I'm really a boat builder, not a barrel maker. And they said, no, I can't do that. You know, you have to do that. And in reflecting on that later in the months since then, I don't have a ready answer of why they said that, unless, you know, maybe they look at me, they realize I'm a published author, and they see that as something they can't do. And it is hard, and it is a skill set of its own. So I've actually applied for a grant specifically to try to do this. I haven't heard yet. I won't hear for a month or so. But it's definitely not just in the back of my mind.
Speaking of barrels, just had someone join on LinkedIn. Thanks for joining from Takehara. Now, I just did a guide training and vegan seminar in Takehara, and we finished the tour in the amazing Fujishuzo Sake Brewery, and they have giant barrels traditionally made hanging up. And it's such a feature of sake, miso, soy sauce, trying to bring this tradition back. So what you're doing and documenting is very wanted now, but many people like Yamamoto-san at Yamaroku have realized, oh man, this knowledge is dying. And so it's really important to have these events, to have this preservation pass on to future generations, right?
And again, what's so different about, and you know, Yamamoto and his fellow barrel makers, you know, they all are intimately familiar with the sort of the old style Japanese apprenticeship, which would be a barrel maker taking one or two young people into their shop to work for 6 years for nearly no pay, you know, and I think they've recognized like that's a hard sell in this world. They've just come up with this alternative, which I think is pretty exciting. I mean, I think in a Western context, we would say, well, we'll teach a workshop. You know, we'll have a craft school and we'll teach a workshop and it'll be a set amount of time and so on. And they're doing it differently. But I think it's great. I'm really happy to play any part that I can. So we'll see if I can get this grant funding. You know, I might come back to Japan and join that gang because they travel around the country and collectively build barrels for sake brewers, soy sauce makers, miso makers, and so on.
That's so wonderful. I had the chance to go to Yamaroku and talk about you with Yamamoto-san.
Recently?
No, this is last year.
Oh, okay.
And I mentioned that you were doing wooden barrels and the Sado boat, which is like a wooden barrel. And he, of course, knew you and really wanted to get in touch. So that was wonderful to be able to connect you both, give your email to him. And I'm so glad you were able to get there last year.
I never knew till this moment that you're
really?
The reason for that invitation.
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad it worked out. He was so sad to hear that you'd been in Japan, but he hadn't been able to connect to you.
Oh, okay.
So it worked out perfectly. And of course, when you visit his beautiful Shoyu making factory, brewery, you can see all these old wooden barrels and all the amazing important fungus that's growing everywhere. And he talks about these barrels being really old, more than 150 years, right?
Yeah, a century old, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we had Eric Clips has joined from YouTube. Great to have you here, Eric. And he says, at least some of the old barrel fungus has survived. In Yamaroku, so maybe you've been there as well.
That's where I was a year ago.
Your pictures about the barrel making, I was really interested to see this. Can you describe what we're seeing?
So when you know you're looking at, these are sections of the barrel sort of prefabricated, so they've put them together. You know, these are just each a certain percentage of one barrel. But the reason I took this picture is if you note the red and the white, that's the heartwood is the red and the sapwood is the white. And what's incredible is how in that plank, those planks, they have tried to line up the boundary between heartwood and sapwood. Going from plank to adjacent plank. And therefore, when this barrel's put together, it will have more or less that unbroken boundary around the barrel. And that's believed to be essential to the function of a soy sauce barrel.
Amazing.
And, you know, I need to explore this. Is that true of sake barrels or miso tubs and so on? And I was so intrigued by it. I reached out to a wood technologist I know who lives in Maine, Richard Jagels. And I asked him about it. And he said that, in fact, that he claims that's a barrier to the passage of alcohol through the wall, through the sides of the barrel. So anyway, yeah, it's a
that's amazing.
It's fascinating.
I was just at the Minka Khan, a conference for people who love old traditional houses, and they had a seminar where they showed us how they made yakisugi, the burnt wood with the cedar.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the Timber Framers Guild people from America was noticing how all of the wood they were burning with what he described to me as a novice. He said, smile up. So okay, the smile
yeah.
was
so that's
up.
Heartwood, right?
Heartwood, right? Smile yes. upside was where they were burning. And he was really intrigued by that. There's so many interesting reasons how they do these traditional things is fascinating.
Correct. And so boat builders do the same thing. Boat builders orient the heartwood and sapwood. And a very interesting thing is, so in a barrel, the heartwood is to the inside. It's to the liquid. So guess what my tugboat teacher did?
The opposite?
It was reversed. The heartwood is to the outside because in a tugboat, the liquid is on the outside. And boat builders in Japan do that too. They orient the heartwood to the water, to the outside. Yes. And so that is interesting. So house builders too, in general, I mean, I think the basic explanation there is that heartwood is more durable to the elements and to, you know, resisting rot and that sort of thing than sapwood. So you're putting that's your line of defense. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the big hurdles we've talked about before is braiding the bamboo. Now you joined them for actually harvesting the bamboo, seeing the whole process, right?
Yes. Yeah. Which I've, you know, of course I did before with tugboats, but they had some interesting innovations. That picture, this workstation they've created, and in the previous picture, it's the same sort of setup. Yeah, it's a platform with that pipe rigidly mounted, and they're using that as a splitter. And we were shoving the bamboo through there to get the initial split, and we could do subsequent ones. And then if you go to the next photo that you had, then that same kind of setup becomes a workbench you can sit on. And he's bracing his draw knife. He's pulling the strips over the blade, past the blade. And now that rigid vertical pipe, he can put the other, it acts as a stop. He can put the other handle of the tool against that. So he can pull with one hand, hold the tool with one hand, and the pipe essentially provides a third hand.
And
my,
then
my tugboat teacher did that with his foot.
Oh my gosh.
He would
and
sit
then
cross-legged.
It becomes like this foot that we see in the picture around the barrel, the braided bamboo.
Right.
And Setuchi explorer David Bira went to the workshop last year and documented some of it. And he showed pictures of the inside, that
correct,
there's actually a braiding inside before the bamboo cover, which I had never seen before. Amazing.
Yeah. Yes. So that's right. So when you braid the hoops, the material is a flat strip. So when you braid it, it naturally forms a cupped cross shape. That's just physically how it's going to form itself. The barrel makers like to fill that. You can almost see that cup shape to the inside as that hoop is being braided. They fill that. They just take strips of bamboo, just single strips of bamboo, and they just wrap them around and around, and then they bind them up in that rope, that rice straw rope.
It's beautiful.
And that becomes like a core. And that serves a number of functions. You can kind of adjust the tightness of the hoop with that. We actually were making those in different thicknesses. So as hoops were fitted on the barrel, you could say, oh, well, we need a big core, grab one from our supply, you know, and so on. And so those get, and that holds that convex shape to the hoop.
And then, of course, no like glue or nails. They use bamboo nails.
Bamboo dowels, essentially.
Yamamoto-san. And then this pounding the base into the bucket, into the barrel?
Into the bottom, yeah.
Amazing. And Yamamoto-san, when we visited his shoyu factory, was saying how the soy sauce, just like miso, just like sake, as the liquid is sat in the barrel, it actually seals it as well. So it has, over time, it becomes more sealed and it might expand the wood, but it adds to the flavor. I just love his explanation of everything. Amazing.
Yeah. Well, it's so fascinating. I mean, the viewer who mentioned the molds and things, Yamamoto actually says individual barrels in his soy sauce warehouse taste different. And he swears this, and he says, I can go to each barrel and I can detect a different taste. I mean, he's like a sommelier, you know. And he actually bottles a blend, because he said, I just don't think the buying public, you know, could appreciate this. Like, it would just confuse them, you know, these subtle flavors. And we're not going to bottle a different, you know, brand or a different version out of every thing. So he actually creates a blend and sort of homogenizes it. But I mean, that's just extraordinary that individual barrels sitting next to each other actually have a discernible difference in taste. Yeah.
And I had no idea that you can use the barrels so long, over 150 years for these beautiful wooden barrels. They age the soy sauce for 4 years, I believe.
Yeah, Yamamoto, I think so. Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, miso makers, sake makers, they're using it in different ways as well. But recently, I've seen also whiskey makers in Japan want the wooden barrels. So they're really in high demand, right?
Yeah, so it's that's a good question. The other element, if you go to the Kyoke, they don't call it a festival, the summit, I think they call it. You know, most of the people there are food producers, and it's really fascinating to meet them and talk to them. And they are all people, soy, miso, sake, etc., that are trying to promote a product brewed traditionally in wood. And it is like Yamamoto says himself, I believe he says only 2% of Japan's total soy sauce production is brewed in wood. And Yamamoto's point is, if we can just raise that 1%, that's a 50% increase in the number of barrels we need. And, you know, and he's saying that's all we need to completely save the craft. And he's, you know, he's right. I mean, it would involve, it would probably require dozens of new craftspeople nationwide, which would be a wonderful thing to see. And so the food side of it is every bit as fascinating and every bit as much passion and talent and all of it, you know, just believing in these natural fermented products and, you know, wanting to interest the public in turning back to them.
Amazing. Yeah. Before we move on, I would like to mention we're going to do a giveaway of one of your amazing books. And I'm going to buy these books from Douglas. So whoever writes in the comments first, a great comment about how you would love to have one of Douglas's books, please let us know which one you're interested in. If you live in North America, Douglas said he's kind enough to send it to you, a signed copy. And if you're in Japan, he's kind enough to bring it when he comes on his next trip. And I will send that to you from Japan. So Japanese Wooden Boat Building, this was your first book, right,
Douglas? No, this is not my first book.
Oh, not the first.
No. This the Tub Boat book was my first book. And this
first book is bilingual. You have Japanese and English, right?
It's Japanese and English, yes. And then I published a monograph in 2014. And then then Japanese Wooden Boat Building came out in 2015. That's about my first five apprenticeships and Japan's last shipwright, traditional shipwright, 2015 for that. And then you showed another book. That's a project I did in 2017. I'm going to guess the book came out maybe 2019. And there is a free download of the Japanese version of that book. And there is now also a free download of my book on building the Sabani of Okinawa. That's also in Japanese. So the free downloads are both in Japanese.
Is that from your website?
If you go to my website.
I just shared your website address. So if anybody's interested, they should be able to find it there, right?
DouglasBrooksBoatBuilding.com.
Wonderful.
And if you can't find it, you can email me from the website. I'm happy to send you those links. So those are two books in Japanese, free download.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And then, of course, your upcoming project, you're going to join the barrel making in Shodoshima.
Right.
But you're really coming to do another project as the last apprentice of a craftsperson before he retires. This is in Hiroshima, right?
Yeah, in the mountains of Hiroshima, a city called Miyoshi, city town. And what happened is so in Miyoshi, they fish with cormorants. That's done in about a dozen places throughout Japan. There's one of the Miyoshi, historic photo, one of the Miyoshi boats. You can see the birds in the water. And this has a 450-year history in Miyoshi. It has a 1,300-year history in Japan, with Gifu being by far the most famous place associated with cormorant fishing. But all the places that do it now, a dozen or so towns, it's done for tourists. And so this is an important tourist business in Miyoshi. And they have a boat builder, but he's retiring. And I met him, I met him about 10 years ago, I think. And we've been in touch, and I know he's visited me when I've been on projects in Japan. Very nice man. And he, almost a year ago, reached out to me and said, I'm retiring. I'm building one last cormorant fishing boat, and you better be here to document it. Now, one thing I should tell you, of the, you know, probably over the years, 60 or 70 boat builders that I've met, interviewed, photographed in Japan, throughout Japan, I've been to all 47 prefectures and found boat builders in all 47 prefectures. River boat builders never used any drawings whatsoever. Never met a freshwater boat builder who used a drawing. They worked entirely from memory and maybe a few patterns that only they know how, they understand how to use. So that's kind of what I'm expecting. You know, I'm not expecting to find him with any drawings. So as his apprentice, I will be documenting all his design secrets and all of his techniques. And I should point out, that's entirely with his blessing. I mean, he's absolutely encouraging. It's why he invited me specifically to document it. And the city of Miyoshi has been very cooperative with this project, and they're offering in-kind support because they realize they need this documentation to try to further, you know, to bring forward a new generation of boat builders. So the other really exciting thing about this is, I'll backtrack a little more. 2 years ago, a Japanese filmmaker reached out to me and said, you know, I discovered your work, looked at your website. I would so love to do a documentary about you working with a traditional boat builder in Japan. And I had to write him back and say, I mean, I've always wanted that kind of thing. Not for the movie star good looks and showcasing that, but to document, to have film, to have footage of these techniques and working would just be invaluable. But I had to say to him, there's almost no one left to work with. I mean, that last generation is almost gone. And we talked about different people. We thought about approaching some boat builders I know that have been retired and trying to convince them to come out of retirement, but we'd have to raise a lot of money, commission a boat from them, and so on. And then last spring, out of the blue, this dropped from the sky. So we've done a crowdfunding campaign. I successfully got some grant funding from an American foundation. So we're able to do this, and I'm committed to producing a publication, drawings, complete narrative of how the boat is built. And Chikara Motomura is the filmmaker's name. He's based in California. He's going to do a documentary film as well as a how-to video. So
that's so exciting, but also
it's very exciting.
The visual side of it is so important. Douglas, absolutely. You've talked about this before, how even when you're talking with these craftspeople and you're trying to sit at a desk and talk about it, and they're like, let me hopeless. Go show you, right?
Right. It's always about showing. Yes. Yeah, no, I think I gave up long ago. I mean, I'll interview boat builders about, you know, their life, their education, their work, you know, that sort of thing. But when it comes to, you know, how is a boat put together, I realize they're going to want to take a piece of wood and a tool and show me, which is great, which is fine. So.
And this style of Japanese wood boat building pedagogy is you're following with your students in America, right? You're doing it in silence.
Right now I'm teaching a 4-week winter term class at Middlebury College here in Vermont, and we are building the timber frame of a Japanese tea house. And we are just over halfway through the process. So these are some shots from class. So one of the conceits about my class is that these workshop sessions are conducted in complete silence. That's 3 hours a day, 4 days a week. Tomorrow's Thursday, we'll have our last workshop session for the week. And then following that session after lunch, the class gathers and we have a 90-minute discussion, which is, you know, just sort of your classic college classroom. Because my students journal, they write papers, and they have readings. And we discuss what's going on. We discuss the readings and their experiences in the shop. And it's been, I've now taught it. It's my fifth winter term at Middlebury College. It's the fifth college that I've taught this class at. Previous classes have been building Japanese boats. So this is a new wrinkle on my course, but otherwise it just falls into place. I mean, we could build a barrel. And in fact, a lot of my students, when they learn a bit about my work, at the end of the class, I ask them, well, you know, how could I improve this course? What could we do differently? And the number one answer is, let's build a giant barrel. So maybe
that would be really cool. A Vermont craft brewery or whiskey would want to use it.
Maker,
you never know.
Massachusetts. Yeah, I mean, there are some sake makers. So, yeah, we could get some sponsorship.
Very cool. So I wanted to ask you more about that philosophy, the spiritual side of boat building, because I often talk to carpenters like John Stollenmeyer in Japan, and he talks about even when you're choosing the tree in the forest or probably when you were cutting bamboo, was there some kind of ceremony to give respect to nature before you cut the trees or before you launch the boat? At least you must have a ceremony before it goes in the water, right?
Yeah, so traditional loggers did perform ceremonies. They would actually build a torii gate in the forest out of just, you know, saplings that they would initially cut down. And that would be to thank, you know, nature and the spirit of the mountain for the material. Boat builders, all ceremonies around Japanese boat building are Shinto based. And the two ceremonies are a keel laying ceremony, which actually has a counterpart in the West. So a keel laying ceremony when the backbone of the boat is completed and before you start planking it. And then, yes, a launching ceremony. And we will, buildings the same way. No doubt, Joy, you've seen, you know, the little bamboo rope around a building site. That's a pre-construction, you know, ceremony. And then a Shinto dedication. And we are next, a week from tomorrow, we'll be having a Shinto dedication of our tea house It's going to be biased towards some boat building traditions because that's what I know best, but it's all Shintoism. And, you know, we have the basics. We have the basics covered. So
that's so cool. Yeah. What a great experience for your students in Vermont. What a unique course.
It's a unique course.
Yeah. But you're also doing workshops in Japan this year.
Yes.
For small groups as well. Could you tell us about those?
Yeah. So I, in addition to teaching at the high school and university level, I teach at maritime museums and craft schools and, you know, any venue that wants to sponsor a workshop. And I've developed a 1 week boat building workshop. We build a 22-foot traditional Japanese riverboat that's actually from the Shinanogawa in Niigata Prefecture. And I usually ask about 10 students. We work 8 hours a day for 5 days, 5 or 6 days, and build that boat. And I'm very excited because the end of May, I'll be teaching that for the first time in Japan. It's not my first teaching in Japan, but this 1 week workshop, it's a first for that. And I hope to be able to do more. And this is at the Mount Fuji Wood Culture Society, which is an amazing institution, relatively new, founded by a chair maker. And I guess it's fair to say most of what's happening there is furniture related, but my hat's off to him. His name is Tak Yoshino, and he approached me and he said, "I really believe in what you're trying to do, and can I sponsor one of your workshops?" So we met last year. I went to see him and meet him and see the school. We continued to talk about it. We finalized it. And I think it only took us about 3 weeks to get actually 11 students from around the world, 4 Japanese, 4 Americans, and 1 each from Great Britain, Mexico, and South Korea. So that's the last week of May.
Yeah.
And if you're around Kawaguchiko, which is on the north side of Mount Fuji, so get in touch with me because we'll be launching the boat in the lake and, you know, doing a Shinto ceremony.
What were the dates again for that one?
It's May 25th to the 29th.
Okay.
So we'll have launch probably on the afternoon of the 29th.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. What a great experience.
Yeah.
So it's not full yet. It's still possible for people to join.
We're full.
Just be able to come in and watch a little bit or
this, I believe. Yeah. Visitors are welcome.
Okay. Great.
School. Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. Make prior arrangement. Probably best thing is reach out to me and I'll confirm that and make that happen. Yeah. So, and there's a couple other venues in Japan that are interested in hosting me. So you may see more of these workshops, you know, stay in touch via my website. And of course, there are workshops being planned in the United States, too. Yes. And I'm also talking to folks in France, Tasmania, and Great Britain.
That's amazing.
Well, they got to come through.
You're in high demand, Douglas.
To them. Yeah. Well, everybody's interested. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny. I've benefited. I'm in a niche. And what I've benefited from is how Japanese timber tools and timber framing and carpentry have just taken the world by storm. And there are just so many people outside of the Japanese have no idea how much their tool makers and their woodworking and their architecture is revered in the rest of the world. And all kinds of practitioners around the world. And, you know, and I think I'm benefiting that people kind of go, whoa, Japanese boat building, never thought of that. So it's great. And my hat's off, you mentioned John Stollenmeyer. I mean, I think what they're doing is just fantastic stuff.
They're trying to do workshops more too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
To train next generation in traditional wooden carpentry, traditional styles, very similar vein to you. And then, of course, Asby Brown always talks about you and his his design focus is all about how we actually as humans appreciate handcrafted things more. And so the more we're losing this with technology is dangerous for us living healthy lives, as well as all that beauty and culture being lost, right?
Absolutely. Well, you're preaching to the choir.
I know. But he's often mentions you as well. So we are all trying to do our part.
That's sweet. Yeah. No. He's amazing. And his body of work, just beyond architecture and social justice and his artwork, he's extraordinary.
Yeah.
So I'm going to one up any adjectives. He's extraordinary. I'm merely a fool. So. Oh.
Well, no, we would never say that. What you're doing is very important. We value you very much. Now, one thing you're doing with your work, which we've talked about before, is you're actually telling secrets. Because yes. As craftspeople, these are trade secrets they would never usually want to tell people outside the trade, right?
Yeah.
But that's a purpose. Now they want you to tell the secrets to preserve the culture, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Without getting too far into it, I had an encounter last year. I gave a paper at a conference, and I won't say accused. Somebody raised the issue of cultural appropriation. It was an academic conference. And so that was a sort of a buzzword in the air. And so they asked me. And I did explain that every single one of my teachers absolutely understood my intent and supported it. Okay. And I mean, the most blatant example is this most recent invitation where he said, literally, you must come and document my work. And so a lot of people say to me, well, but why? You know, they spent their lifetimes, you know, guarding these secrets. Why suddenly open it all up to you? And I think the answer is all my teachers were in their 70s and 80s at the time I worked with them. And I think they all had come to the realization of what was about to be lost. And who would appreciate that better than the practitioners and their customers, right? The boat builders and the fishermen.
And you often say a lot of the people you studied with never had apprentices at all.
Well, right. 7 of my 9 teachers have never had an apprentice. So I was their last chance, you know, and they were very proud people. I mean, my Tokyo teacher was a 4th generation boat builder and intensely proud of his family's legacy of craftsmanship. And yeah, how you know, we can only imagine, how did that feel to him to realize it ends with me? And then I come along and I tell people, you know, I think my timing was perfect. Had I come 10 or 20 years earlier, I know I would have had a very different reception. And in fact, in Hiroshima, down by Iwakuni, I was introduced to a boat builder. He was 85 years old, Hashimoto-san. Hashimoto, yeah. And we were having a great conversation. We were in his boat shop and I was asking about his tools and his boats and this and that. And incredibly friendly. And then suddenly he looked at me and said, you know, if you'd walked in here 10 years ago, I'd have thrown you right out. And it was shocking, you know, what he said. And then I was just speechless. And then he looked at me and he said, but now it's time to document my work. And he was actually crushed. He was about to start building a boat and he assumed I lived in Japan. Aww. And he was just saying, you're here, right? You're going to be here, right? And I had to tell him, no, I fly home to America. I can't stay. And he was really visibly disappointed. So yeah, Yeah, I don't think craftspeople I don't think they necessarily want to take their secrets to the grave. I mean,
no,
why right? would they have taken on apprentices, you know?
Well, that, you know, with tears in their eyes, asking you to be their last apprentice, you've documented a few times, right, in your experience. Yeah. I love this picture you shared of the secrets in the barrel too. That John Stollemeyer told me how in traditional houses, they always have a plaque which says who worked on this house, all the different people involved. And I had no idea that also inside barrels, they're documenting the makers, or what do they write?
So that's Fujita-san, and that's the man that called me at 3 a.m. He is quite a collector of old barrels, and the messages are on the edges of the staves. So when you put the barrel together, they're hidden forever. Okay. So and my tugboat teacher did this too. Because his first career was also building barrels. Tugboat building was like a retirement career for him. So Fujita-san has been going all over Japan and like tearing apart old rotten barrels and reading what's on the edges. And he told me it's everything from names of craftspeople to the weather, recording the weather, presumably the day they put it together, recording the wages of the craftspeople. It's a fascinating kind of craft anthropology, really.
That's incredible.
And at the Kiyoke event, before the barrels are assembled, I have a photo. All the staves are laid out on the floor on edge, and there are brushes, and people are invited to do whatever they want, sign whatever they want. Yeah. And then they do the bottoms. Yeah.
So that's more visual. This part's more visual.
That was as traditional.
Really?
I think barrel makers, they hid the messages in the staves. Yeah.
Did you sign this one as well?
No, I don't think I signed it. No.
Well, you have to sign the next one, Douglas. Okay. You have to be a part of it. You have to be a part of history, because in 200 years, when this barrel is rotted, you know, somebody will look you up. Awesome.
Put my website address.
Right, which who knows if they'll use websites.
I'll write your Instagram handle. How's that?
Oh yeah, let's
hashtag
do it.
Hashtag Joy Walsh.
I love it. So I love that you're learning all these things, you're documenting it in books, you're teaching your students in America, you're teaching people in Japan as well. You're being such a bridge. How do you have the energy for all of this, Douglas?
I jog.
Okay, good for you. Good for you.
Been running since I was in 10th grade, so that helps.
Yeah, that's awesome. You did talk about, there was a great interview with you in Unpacking Japan.
And
you went to Osaka and did that interview. That's a great interview series.
They did a great job. Yeah,
fantastic. I did that as well when they first got started. So it's lots of fun. They've got a great selection of people.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you would do more in Japan if you had more funding. So the funding is a big hurdle, is it?
Absolutely. That's been the hardest thing. I mean, you know, so I did my first apprenticeship in 1996. I mean, at that point, if I had had unlimited funding, I probably could have been apprenticing with boat builders almost nonstop. You know, there were that many left. There is no one else doing what I'm doing. So, you know, So the funding has been difficult. I didn't have any grant funding. I paid for my 96 apprenticeship out of my own pocket, and I paid for my second apprenticeship out of my own pocket. I got my first big grant around the year 2000. It's still the largest single grant I've ever gotten. And that brought me to Japan for an entire calendar year and two apprenticeships, one in Tokyo and one in Aomori. And then, you know, apprenticeships beyond that have all been grant funded. But yeah, I mean, it takes years. It took me you know, the tsunami struck in 2011, and I had met, I had traveled that coastline several times, and I knew all the boat builders. And I found out, well, one died soon after the tsunami. He lost everything, his shop, his house, his patterns, his tools, everything. And he died in a in refugee housing. Another boat builder, I never found out. I never could get a response. And I was determined, so there was one boat builder left that I knew, and I was determined to document his work because the entire material culture had been destroyed. And it took me 4 years to raise that funding. Finally, in 2015, I was able to go over and apprentice with him. So, wow. Yeah, no, it's been an uphill battle, and I've raised about $400,000 in, you know, the last 25 years. About 90% of that money has been from American foundations. So,
yeah, I hear this from artisans and craft people who are passionate about keeping these things alive in Japan all the time, how there is no apprentice system that's easy for people to access. There's the government talking about some funding for young people who want to learn as apprentices.
That would be fantastic.
Is there a viable job for them is the big question once they get the training. But a lot of artists seem interested in doing the training. And then even if they don't be specifically a barrel maker, they have that knowledge and they can do a variety of things as an artist. That might
a lot of options. I think my feeling in boat building is, I think there is a market because I'm going to go out on a limb and say this. I think there are more traditional wooden boats in the tourist industry in Japan than in any other country in the world. There are a lot of wooden boats, and those companies are all losing or have lost their boat builders. I made a proposal to a city, probably shouldn't mention their name. They needed a new fleet of tourist boats, and they were wood and they were 30 or 40 years old and they needed to be replaced. And I was bidding on it, and the city went with fiberglass boats. And they just were afraid of wood. They thought, well, won't plastic be so much easier? Anyway.
Oh, that's heartbreaking. Someone who works in tourism, I can tell you the value of having authentic, a traditionally made, handcrafted wooden boat like it used to be as you're trying to highlight the history. It's invaluable. This will bring people to use the boat and to just see it. And then if you were doing a workshop there, actually building it, training locals as a part of this tourism product.
That was actually part of my proposal.
That would be huge.
Yeah, huge. It would be huge. And you do know that, I mean, on the positive side, I built a wooden tour boat for Ritsurin Koen in Takamatsu. And 3 years ago, I built 6 river boats for the Kumagawa Funakodari in Kumamoto Prefecture. So that company has always had wooden boats. They lost their entire fleet to the terrible flooding of 2020, and they came to me for 6 36-foot boats, which I built over the course of 2022 and 2023.
Well, that highlights to me how important this documentary, working with you for a documentation of the film, is so important, because I went to Ritsurin Koen recently. Oh. I went in those boats. I had no information about you being a part of rebuilding those, or if they document this is a dying art, but we had these boats specially made to bring back, preserve this tradition. That is huge value in terms of tourist interest, right?
Yeah, right. It's part of the story. Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, next time you're there, stamp your foot and put your hands on your hips and say, what's the story?
Yes. And you should have pictures and explanation in English and Japanese, you know, or put it on your website, right?
This is a true story. I've been, you know, in the garden. And of course, I was working in Takamatsu, not far away, building the riverboats. So I visited the garden a few times. And actually, the tour boat was going past me. I was on shore. And I heard the boatman say, you know, a gaijin built this.
So. Had he known, he would have been that foreign boat builder. Give him a hand, a round of applause, you know, that could be part of the tour.
No, so I agree with you. I mean, I think heritage tourism, you know, is a huge thing in the rest of the world. And authenticity matters. I definitely think there is a market. And I mean, as it's true in this country, we talk about a revival of wooden boat building here in America and Europe and Oceania. And it's also about you start to build them and you start to create that momentum that keeps getting more boats built. So, you know, who knows where it could go? There's all kinds of directions it could go. So
I'm going to do a little pitch to anybody working in tourism. Every castle in Japan that has a moat needs one of these traditional wooden boats. You need to hire Douglas or someone who does wooden boat building, bring them, do a workshop, do a big media push. And when they're built, that is part of the added value.
Yeah.
That is part of the appeal. That's what the visitors are interested in, these great stories.
Right.
They don't know about these dying arts. A lot of Japanese people don't realize these traditions are dying. This culture is dying, right?
Right. Yeah. Actually, should I talk about the boat in Japan I really have my eye on?
Yes.
Really? Am I going to get us in trouble?
Go ahead.
Am I going to get us in trouble?
No. But why? You'd be fine.
So in Uji, south of Kyoto.
Yeah, near Kyoto, famous for tea and the Heian period, Tale of Genji. Yeah, a very traditional area.
Right. So they have ukai.
And is that a kind of boat? Ukai?
That's the cormorant fishing boat.
Oh, okay.
And the fisher person is a woman. That's amazing.
Amazing.
The only Japanese woman usho. The boats are aluminum.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Because the Tale of Genji Museum is there. It's so beautifully done. They have wooden palanquins that they used to carry around the elite with. Why?
I don't know.
Let's build some wooden boats there for sure.
I would love to. Yeah. And part of a big part of my work, if you go to my website, hit the about page, you'll find my resume, is a lot, I guess I call it public interest or exhibition boat building. Cause I agree with you, Joy, that's the argument I make. Don't just order a boat from me and have me build it in a warehouse and bring it on a truck. Let's set it up so that the building of the boat, you know, creates this interest and energy and excitement. It's just value added. And then
100%.
And then you have the boat. So and invite the public, you know, invite the public to help, to volunteer, to watch.
Correct.
And get involved.
You could even set you guys up in a little stage area.
There you go. All right.
I don't know how practical that is, but that would really draw a lot of photographers, a lot of local interest, a lot of visitors would love to see that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. So, and I've had those successes, you know, I've done mostly that kind of work outside of Japan, but I've done a few exhibition boats in Japan. And yes, I think all those exhibitions, because that's kind of a rare thing in Japan. Japanese museums, there are not many institutions that actually display working crafts.
Yes.
That's a well-worn thing outside of Japan, not so common in Japan. So, I mean, I think, to me, that just says the audience is there. And
absolutely. And if you are doing the building inside a museum or a workshop, there's no reason we can't use technology and have a live stream around the world of what you guys are doing. We have ways to spread the message and spread the knowledge. We can't keep these things in the dark. We need to share the knowledge to keep it going for future generations, right?
That's the goal. That's the idea. Awesome.
Well, that's pretty much our time. I just want to mention once again, I am buying a book from Douglas. If you would like one of Douglas's books, please write which book you're interested in and where you live, and we will send it to you. So please definitely do that in the comments. And if you're in Japan, I'll send it. If you're in North America, Douglas will send it. And if you're in Europe, you're out of luck. Is that right, Douglas?
Well, if you're in Europe, write to me because I have Europeans contact me, and I've discovered a couple of sources in Europe where people can go buy. The problem is U.S. postal rates are ridiculous.
Yes.
Reach out to me if you're interested in the books. And there's a purchase page at my website, so you can at least look at the three books in English that I have published. And, you know, tell Joy which one, if you win this sweepstakes. Tell Joy what you want. Joy, you got to send me the winning
Of course.
Entry.
Of course. As soon as I get it.
Okay.
But also, Douglas, thank you so much for all the great work you're doing. You are coming to Hiroshima. I will make an effort to get to you and at least get those books if someone wins it in Japan. But I want my own signed copy. So, of course, that's the benefit of buying it directly from Douglas. You get a signed copy. You can find these at booksellers around the world, right, Douglas?
Amazon is a place to go, yeah. But signed copies only from my website.
So thank you so much, Douglas.
Did we
miss anything? Is there anything else you want to have your last message? Are you good?
I'm good. DouglasBrooksBoatBuilding.com or just Google Japanese wooden boats and you'll find me.
Awesome. And if you're in Japan around Mount Fuji in May, get in touch with Douglas as well. You might be able to go and see. If you're in Hiroshima in February, could they come and see you in Miyoshi?
The city of Miyoshi has got a website specifically for our project, and people are welcome to stop by. But again, probably a good idea. Reach out to me if you're listening to this, and then I can provide you the information.
Fantastic. And of course, I will put all the links below. Thank you, everybody, for watching, and keep in touch. Write your comments. We will get back to you.
Okay.
Take care.
Thank you so much,
Douglas. Thanks, everyone.
All right. Bye.